Support for this podcast comes from Frito-Lay and the 2023 Snack Bracket Championship. The Frito-Lay Snacker Challenge is underway, and fans are voting on their favorite snacks to crown champion. We're talking about primetime matchups between the best 64 snacks in the land. Will Ruffles Ridges reign supreme? Can Doritos defend their dynasty? Or will Smart Food use their smarts for a surprise upset? Only you can decide. Get in on all the action for a chance to win up to $1,000 or a year's worth of snacks. Let your snacks be heard. Just go to FritoLaySnackIt.SBNation.com to vote and enter for a chance to win. No purchase necessary. Sweepstakes ends April 3rd, 2023. Void where prohibited. Year's worth of snacks awarded in the form of 52 coupons, each good for one bag of chips. See official rules at FritoLaySnackIt.SBNation.com.
Welcome in, everybody, to the Longhorn Republic, your source for Texas Longhorn news, sports, and opinions with a bit of snark built in. We are a podcast at Burnt Orange Nation, and you can find more great Texas Longhorn content over at burntorangenation.com. If you like what we do, please leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. It helps get the show out there. Share this with your friends wherever you found it, whether it was Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, anywhere where you find fine podcast content. You can find Kyle and myself. Connect with us on social media at Longhorn Pod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, The Longhorn Republic, or shoot us an email, longhornrepublicpod@gmail.com. My name is Gerald Goodwin, your host this week, like I am every week. And I honestly don't know who I'm joined by because I don't have a depth chart. So why don't you introduce yourself today?
Deion Sanders once described he's always been number 21, even though in college he was number 2. He was number 2 on the roster, number 1 in your hearts. I feel like I'm similarly number 2 on this podcast depth chart, but number 1, hopefully, in the people's hearts. Kyle Carpenter, co-host of the Longhorn Republic. Gerald, I if we had to list a 2-deep of the hosts and all the guests we've ever had in this podcast, it would be tough, and we probably wouldn't release that, and I'm sure all the journalists that cover this podcast would take that perfectly fine.
I don't want to say anything publicly about the people that are doing it because, like, John McClain is very, very nice to me and you as well. I think when going through the sports journalism track at the University of Texas, he was pretty closely involved with that. But, like, the fact that you are a retired professional football writer freaking out about a university that you did not attend, nor do you cheer for, actually, you actively cheer against, not releasing a depth chart is the height of stupidity. Like, John is a much smarter person than this. And so I don't know what's going on. Maybe he's just bored. Like, yeah. Maybe he was missing the controversy of supporting Art Briles as much as he did. Like, I don't know what, but, like, it's just been weird. Like, put the phone down, walk away. You've earned a retirement, man. Just, like, give it a break.
Yeah, yes, he is the most visible and vocal, and again, a Baylor grad, no matter when you graduated, will always take any chance to take a shot at Texas, my wife included. I think it is just part of its, I think it's a first-year course. You don't even have to graduate. If you go to Baylor, it's a first-year, first-semester course on hating UT and taking shots at every turn. So again, I don't fault him. It is, now that he's retired, his main prerogative as a Baylor grad, right? He's not a writer anymore. He's a Baylor grad, and every Baylor grad will take their shots at UT all day, every day. But it is, you know, it's a very, very stupid and dumb thing to be upset about. It's funny. I think I've seen some of our own fans being upset about it. I don't understand. It's a depth chart, guys. There's a real-life thing that happens on Saturdays, typically, that you know, we'll tell you who the ones are, usually who the twos are. So if you don't know which freshman is, like, slotted in at the number 4 at a certain position, I'm really sorry, and I hate that for you.
The craziest thing in my mind are the two conversations that I'm seeing of, one, that Sark wanted to list it as Ewers or Card. And that's coming from basically the equivalent of sliced bread from the OU side that has sources highly placed. And then the other one is that because a guy like Ethan Burke, who we talked about in our D-line preview, has a really high upside, we thought had a really long development curve, but he's worked his way into the 2-deep. And so the other conversation is that Sark didn't want to hurt guys' feelings ahead of the game. And I don't know if you ever heard Steve Sarkisian talk, but he doesn't seem like he's super concerned with hurting folks' feelings. Like, he is pretty candid, pretty raw, pretty honest. And so, like, it seems like it's really just, again, the depth chart matters to nobody outside of the locker room, right? Like, it doesn't matter at all.
And those guys know it, right? There is no denying when you line up with ones and twos who's taking the reps. Like, it's not like you four guys stand there with the ones, okay, and you're all going to be defensive end today. It's not youth, you know, soccer, right? There is a hierarchy that naturally distills here. And to the other point, just the, like, the fake sources and things. Like, I mean, the guy named a freaking starter. Like, I don't understand what the controversy that is trying to be drummed up. But again, if I took a shot at Baylor, I will equally do one for OU. To their credit, like, I didn't realize the internet strength, and Gerald, you are out there, but is this strong in all parts of rural Oklahoma? But those guys are constantly online and monitoring every Texas news story and commenting on it, and apparently voting in fan polls very religiously. Like, they are a very online fan base, and Texas, you know, having Texas as your main rival certainly gives you a lot to talk about all the time. So stay mad, I guess.
It's wild to me that on the Monday after we had actual football on the screen and the Monday of the actual first game week, we got the most off-season of off-season stories, controversies ever. But we're not here to talk about depth charts. I mean, we might talk about depth charts a little bit. We're here to close out our previews. We're going to talk about the defensive backs and the special teams, a big question mark. We'll also do a bit of a season preview. We've been doing it on and off, again, for the last 12-ish weeks, so go back on Thursdays and check us out. But we've got a little bit to talk about. We'll talk about expectations for the year. Like, what does that look like? We'll close the show out. We've got a pack down the 40, Kyle. It feels good. The ladies were in action over the weekend representing the University of Texas. We'll obviously close the show out with some bang the drum. So there's a lot of controversy, conversation, consternation about the moniker of defensive back university. And I'm not here to adjudicate that. They're much larger, much, you know, more notable people that actually have stats that are going to talk about it. But the University of Texas has called itself at times DBU, and probably for good reason in the early 2000s, but have kind of fallen a little bit from that as of late. A year ago, Texas only gave up 224 yards per game through the air. Teams completed like 70% of their completions. You know, it's just not a it's a group that we don't necessarily know what it's going to be this year. There are a lot of experienced guys at the top. There's a lot of inexperienced guys all over the place. Probably some transfer is going to have a lot to say about it. But as we talk about the DBs, and Sark talked about it in his Monday presser, there's like this relationship between the pass rush and the defensive backs, where if they're both decent, then they're both better, right? Because if the quarterback has to go past his kind of three-step drop and throw the ball, is it an advantage to the defensive line and the pass rush? If the pass rush is better, the quarterback can't set his feet, doesn't have as much time to find somebody. Because as we saw in the Nebraska-Northwestern game, if you give a quarterback 12 seconds to complete a pass, he's going to find somebody open. So there's this recursive relationship. And if they both can take a step up, if either one can take a step up, it seems like a situation where both of them can.
Yeah, so the switching to press man coverage is directly related to that, you know, giving, like you said, a bit more time for the blitz to get home, which, again, exactly like you said, I like the word recursive. That was nice. Gives the defense a better chance to be playmakers, right? To here's the thing, right? When you say they only gave up 224 yards per game, there's a couple misleading parts about that stat, right? The fact that they gave up 202.4 yards per game on the ground is why they defenses didn't feel like they had to take as many shots in the air. Texas was gashed for big plays, right? Like, when you think of the big explosive plays against Texas, sure, a few of them came through the air, but a lot of them came on the ground, and that is also the part of defensive backs, is stepping up and stopping. You know, a 9-yard run sucks. You miss the tackle and it's a 43-yard run, and that's way worse, right? So stopping a bad play becoming, you know, a game-changing play, right? So there is a component to the ground game, but, you know, just looking at the kind of traditional metric that you measure defensive backs by, the way that they played, eyes on the quarterback, kind of off the ball in the secondary, should give your defensive backs greater chance to jump in and be playmakers because they see the quarterback. What ended up happening was that quarterbacks just took little underneath stuff against Texas a lot very efficiently and waited for one to break or, again, broke plays on the ground, see Baylor, OU, etc. But, you know, completing against the cornerbacks 70% is not, you know, ideal. And again, I think a lot of it is scheme where they're giving up a lot of short stuff. So you will see a pretty drastic change this year. When you're playing press man, you will see more big plays inevitably that come against the Texas cornerbacks, right? If you have whoever is out there, but if we think it's Jameson Watts, if you have your cornerbacks a bit more on an island and engaging at the line of scrimmage and then having to play catch up if the receiver gets the release, you know, that is a chance for a good quarterback to put that ball over that shoulder, right? And you have to have the speed, you have to have the recovery, the playmaking to either go up, get an interception, go up, get a you know, a PBU. It will require some skill, but again, it will, as Sark said, if you can just add a little hitch in the quarterback's drop, a little bit where he can't just in rhythm step up and throw on the quick three-step drop, which will never allow a rush to get home, right? A five-step drop. If he's got time to sit there, he's going to really rear back and throw the deep ball well. So, you know, this will be different. We will see a little bit of a curve. Obviously, they've had time to do that in the offseason, but against real live offenses. And I think a lot of this is predicated on the fact that it sounds like Ryan Watts will be starting at one of those cornerback spots, and he has the body type for that, right? He is a kind of quintessential NFL press guy, 6'2". He's good at the press. There was some talk when he first came that he could have a safety body because he tackles really, really well. And just is big, big frame, can do a lot of things, but I think it's more perfectly suited for that press. I'm curious to see who the other cornerback is, and our kind of nickel, if that's going to be Jameson and Jahdae Barron. But if it's those two guys, it'll be very curious to see Jameson. If he's pressing, he's his agility is otherworldly. His speed is very, very good. His strength and size are not necessarily his strength. So he will be doing a lot of recovery. But again, you know, if you watch the elite players who play cornerback, right, like the guy who's also the running back on the other side in high school, and they get 12 picks a year, most of them are like, oh, someone's here, and they just jump up and take the ball, right? Can Jameson do that? He was recruited as a receiver. He has that athleticism. He only has 4 career interceptions. He got his first one against Oklahoma State last year since 2019, right? He had a little drought. Can this actually open something up for him where he's got his hips turned and he's playing recovery and just going see ball, make play, and does that unlock something for him? So it will be very curious, right, to see. But I do think, Gerald, you're absolutely correct. There will be some new faces. We're losing a lot of known entities, for good or for bad, in that secondary, right? Like guys who we knew what their ceiling was. We're losing some of those, and it will look different.
When you've got Foster's at Sam Houston State, Brendan Schooler's probably going to make the Patriots this year. Chris Adamora is at the University of Texas finishing school in Dallas. Tyler Owens is at Tech. Darian Dunn, haven't seen his name pop up anywhere. But you could say it's for good, you could say it's for ill. And I think some of these may be addition by subtraction. You know, we can talk about that on another podcast. But, you know, when you've got, like you said, Jameson and Cook kind of holding it down from the fifth. You know, Steve Sarkisian mentioned him in his Monday press conference. Like, Cook has played a lot of football. He's a guy who you can look at to kind of be like a field general back there. He's a guy you can look to show some leadership back there. But I'm really excited to see, like you mentioned, Ryan Watts. That was a huge addition for Texas and kind of one of those that it almost felt like an out-of-the-blue transfer where it's like, oh, but coming back home makes a ton of sense. Terrence Brooks is a kid who, again, I think could come in and potentially play early. He was one of the best corners in the country. He's got that body, he's got the ability, he's got long arms. You're gonna see some freshman mistakes, but I think one of the things that this will hopefully alleviate, one of the biggest issues we saw on the defensive backfield last year was like the miscommunication and the missed handoffs between zones. And that was where a lot of teams found success against Texas, was the handoff between the corner and the safety, or the corner and the nickelback in these deep cover two, cover three zone type schemes. Those weren't happening. They weren't communicating. They weren't turning their hips well. They weren't handing them off well. And that's where a lot of teams found success, in those little moments between the zones. And so playing this press man, again, it's just like, be better than the guy across from you. And more often than not, the guy at Texas should be more talented than the guy across from them. They should have better coaching at this point than the guy across from them. And so that's what I'm hoping and curious to see is, does that translate? Because again, Ryan Watts, Terrence Brooks, those are high four-star, like fringe five-star guys. Like those were top-tier guys. Jalen Gilboa's a guy who people want to, you know, frown on him because of, you know, he had some off the field stuff and it's fine, but like he's come in and made a name for himself. He's come in and really been a stud, and he may end up playing that, like that nickel spot, that kind of hybrid role that we see in this defense. But you know, that one feels like, when we talk about playing young guys, that feels like a get to rather than a have to. And that is what's exciting about a guy like Jalen Gilboa coming in, because I expected him to sit. I expected him to be a redshirt developmental guy, get into your college body, you know, kind of shake off some of the dumb high school mentality you had. But apparently, outside of like that one incident early in camp, he's been a guy that Texas has been able to lean on and look to be a guy in the locker room for them. So I'm excited to see him get some shine. And again, Gary Patterson coming in to hopefully help put some scaffolding under this coaching staff. And, you know, Gary Patterson, defensive back whisperer, defensive back guru, Gary Patterson has put 2- and 3-star guys in the league at defensive back. And so giving Gary Patterson this level of clay to work with, and again, he's not going to be on the sidelines during the game. You can't do that, but he's been in practice and he's been coaching these guys up and he's been in a game planning mode. That's what I'm curious to see. Does that pay off dividends this year for Texas? Because you and I have said it, Texas doesn't need to be A pluses at everything. Texas is not going to be Alabama this year. But if Texas can go from a D minus to a C, that might be a winning solution for Texas.
There's a big group of players, right? You talked about Jamison and Watts at the corner. You talked about the young guys who've come in. And again, I love that young guys are pushing older guys, like, just get in and win your spot, right? That depth chart is who's playing the best, who earned it, right? So get in and win it. Anthony Cook, all of his experience, I think I like what he does back at safety a lot, like you mentioned. But then there's a group of three players that, if you just look at how experienced they are and a next man up mentality, this should be their year. Jahdae Barron, Keaton Crawford, Jaron Thompson. None of them are young. They're all juniors, right? These are third year in the program type of guys. I actually thought they were all sophomores. I was forgetting they, you know, COVID makes everything weird, but I was forgetting this is their third year with the team. So there is an expectation that it's a put up or shut up kind of time, right? Like you could have, you know, two of those guys starting and one playing a lot, right? You could have Crawford at the other safety or Jaron Thompson at the other safety. You could have Jahdae Barron starting, and you need that, right? Or else you're playing those really talented freshmen. I mean, I think Gilboa and Terrence Brooks are both guys who are chomping at the bit to get in there, and that's great. But can the juniors hold them off, right? Not so much Watts, Jamison, and Cook. We know what three of the defensive backs will be, but can Barron, who last year, you know, was quite good, right? Like he had the best catch rate against him on the team, while both our corners were up around 70%, and Josh Thompson is going to make an NFL roster as well, right? And he was one of those two, and Jamison being the other. Those aren't good numbers, right? You want that to be 50%. You want it to be 40% if you're a first-round draft pick, right? But you want it to be 50%. That's just kind of the standard. I think that puts you in the, like, 58% puts you in Pro Football Focus. It's green, right? Like, you want to be in the green. I think Cook and Barron were the only two on our team last year in the green in coverage, right? So Barron at 50%, if he can really lock up that nickel spot as a cover, from a cover stance, and while Cook is just such a good, solid football player, Barron does have a little bit more twitchiness, a little bit more speed. They may not have to shade a safety as much to him. If Barron can truly lock that up a little bit, take away the slot, take away, you know, for the quarterbacks in the Big 12, there's a lot of upside but unprovenness, right, in this conference. If you could take away that safety blanket of the slot receiver, it's the first guy to cross, you know, flash across your eyes, right? It's the first look for most college receivers. It does some things, like we talked about the pass rush helping our corners. It's all symbiotic. So if you can take away that a little bit, have your safeties helping other places, then you know, it makes everyone a little bit better. But that's a big if, right? It's a big if that we're talking about all three of these juniors making a step up as they come in. I really don't know, Gerald. I don't know that the defensive backfield is, I'm not ready to call it a strength. I think it has the potential to be, and there's some interesting pieces, right? Mm-hmm. If Maurice Blackwell is in there, if he's a guy who's playing, it's because he can be what freshman BJ Foster was, where he's just a scare tactic. Because you know he can. Yeah, because he can just, He could destroy someone coming across the middle, and that receiver's not going to want to run across the middle. I think he has a lot still to learn about playing the safety position, but he's ready to hit, and you saw that in the spring game, and I love that. Get the guy in the field. I think he'll probably play a lot of special teams, and again, if he's playing, that probably means that he's taken that little step up. You know, if any of the other guys are J.D. Coffey, you know, any of these players or Jameer Johnson are getting in, I hope that means it's because they are making those steps up, working their way up the depth chart versus, you know, either injury, of course, we, Lord willing, we don't want any more of those, or, you know, these guys who are seniors and juniors not looking like they have that, you know, experience that should be their greatest benefit isn't paying off to make them look like they know what they're doing, where you know, a defensive coordinator is ready to cut bait and give the young guy a shot, right? So I hope we're not in any more of those play the young guys, because, well, at least they try, at least they're running around hard out there. So that is kind of what I'll be watching when it comes to the secondary unit.
You said it, like, I'm not ready to call anything on the defense a strength at this point, just because of what we've seen and where we're at. And again, especially on the, as the defense goes, I'm from Missouri on this, like, you got to show me something. But I think of the groups, when you evaluate their ceilings, I think the defensive backfield, especially the cornerback position, has the highest ceiling to be a strength, right? I think about the guys on along the edges that Texas has brought in, and if they hit their ceiling, I think if some of these cornerbacks hit their ceiling, especially in the cover and what, you know, Texas is going to do this year, I think they could also be a strength. Again, there's a really high ceiling for them. And speaking of something that was a strength that maybe needs to reassess, special teams, Kyle, Jeff Banks, the assistant head coach, the monkey's stepdad, whatever you want to call him, but he's got a job before him. Texas has to replace Cameron Dicker, who was waived by both LA and Baltimore this year, but he was the man in the kicking game for Texas. Texas was number 5 in both punting efficiency and field goal efficiency, basically measuring scoring advantage gained or lost in those two facets of the game. Texas was number 5. Guess whose foot did both of those? Cameron Dicker. So they've got a competition to replace him. It seems like, based on what Steve Sarkisian shared on Monday, that Isaac Pearson, our friend, literal friend of the show, a guy who's been on the podcast with us, is going to be the guy at punter. Sark gave him some specific praise on Monday. And it's weird to hear a coach mentioning the specialist by name, and I'm fine with it. That was a dumb shtick, whatever. So Pearson's going to step in at punter. It seems like Will Stone is going to be the guy for kickoffs, but as far as the point afters and field goals, still some competition. Stone and Burt Auburn, guy, perfect name, perfect main for Texas, are going to battle it out this week. So I'm curious to see how that shakes out, because college kickers is a meme for a reason. And especially in a year where the margins are so slim for Texas, having a solid kicker, having a guy that, you know, you could trot out there and could hit it from 45, 50 yards to get you some points on the board when things get weird, would be an advantage. And Texas just does not have that this year.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it means there's a couple more fourth downs we go for it versus not, which, again, I'm a huge fan of, you know, like 7 out of 10, should you go for it? Yes, just do it. But that's, you know, another conversation. But I do think that Isaac Pearson is ready to step in and be the next great Australian punter at the University of Texas. Don't forget that this gentleman was the number one punter out of Pro Kick Australia, the Australian punter factory, right? Like, he has the pedigree. He put in the work. He's been at Texas. He's bided his time, right? Last year, Dicker took it over, and at first we said, oh, what does that mean for the other punters on the roster? But then you saw Dicker was legitimately maybe a better punter than he ever was a kicker, right? Like, legitimately good. My dream of Justin Tucker, Ravens kicker, Cameron Dicker, Ravens punter is sadly not realized after they waived him. But yeah, I mean, I really like the praise that Pearson's been getting. I've heard people describe being at practice and hearing the sound of his punts, and it just sounds like, you know, he's just thwumping. That's onomatopoeia there. Thwumping them. You know, it's good. I'm excited. But it is a learning curve, right? You are playing real live big boy college football, and we saw even Michael Dixon, one of the greatest college punters of all time, struggle a little bit as he first took over the duty. So we'll see. Give him a little bit of grace, but I think the upside is there for Pearson to lock that down and be a great punter for us. Kickoffs, great. Extra points, field goals, you know, whoever wins it, there's a lot of scrutiny on kickers, man. Like, you have to have a special mind. It's like goalkeepers in soccer. Like, if you make one mistake, everyone talks about it. You know, if you do 12 things in a row right, like, cool, everyone expects it. It's a very tough psychological place to be, where people focus very loudly on your mistakes. So hopefully one of these guys not only has the leg but the mentality, right? I think so much of it is between the ears. Sark also mentioned Dicker missed his first two before he never missed, right? So I don't have a dog in this fight. I do like Burton a lot, just the way he looks. I love that hair. But Will Stone, you know, has an NIL built in to be the next Keystone spokesperson. So once he's 21, of course. But a lot of names here, a lot of interesting things to think about on the kicking side. I'm actually more interested on the returning side, because I believe I heard a report that Deshaun Jameson will be doing kick returns but will not be doing punt returns this year. So the punt returner without a depth chart released will be a little bit of a TBD. Xavier Worthy at one point said he's the best punt returner on the team, which I just love the man's confidence. We have some young guys who've come in with a ton of speed.
Brendan Thompson, gotta go fast, baby.
That's right. You know, maybe Jameson by week six, it's like, nope, we need him, put him out there. He's done it. We know that he can do it. So I'll be very curious who's our punt returner. I do think Jameson will be one of the kick returners, and he's, you know, fourth all time at Texas with like 26 great returns called back, it feels like. So how high can he rise?
Texas in almost punt return touchdowns.
Easily.
That's it on our special teams preview. So we don't know who the kicker or who the punt return and kickoff return specialist will be this year, but we'll find out whenever they trot out there on Saturday. So we're excited. There's actually football to watch in Burnt Orange this weekend.
Today's episode is brought to you by Cars.com. With over 2 million vehicles and 50,000 more added every day, Cars.com will match you with the perfect car for you, your budget, your life, your style. And if you're ready to say goodbye to your current car, Cars.com will get you an instant offer to cash it in. Just start by entering your license plate and get matched with a local dealer who will write you the check. So whether you're looking to buy or sell, just go to Cars.com. It's magical.
So speaking of Burnt Orange football to watch, we've been going through for the last 12 weeks on Thursdays and giving you previews of every team on the schedule. And so we wanted to take a moment and do a little bit of that for the University of Texas. Now, we've gone position by position, week by week, so we're not going to go in there, but we've got a couple of questions that we want to discuss, and I think that'll help us kind of guide the conversation for the next few minutes. So, you know, Texas, coming off a 5-7 season, lost 6 in a row, lost to Kansas on a 2-point conversion. Yes, we're all aware of all those things that can happen. Relatively clean offseason until the last, I don't know, 3 weeks-ish or so. Had two key injuries to Isaiah Nayor and Junior Anguilau. Both will miss the season. Ajayi Hall, transfer in from Alabama on his kind of last rope. Decided to do something that we've all thought about and hit a parking boot with his tire iron until it came off. Don't blame him, honestly. I feel like I would have done that if I was, you know, a little more fearless in college. But there's a lot to unpack. And so, Kyle, what I want to talk about here, just to start, is like, when you think about this season and you think about where you're focusing on, what's the biggest storyline you are watching heading into the season?
I think for me, the single biggest is, you know, can Texas do enough on the offensive side of the ball with a freshman quarterback and with freshmen, probably two of them starting, maybe three, on the offensive line? Can they do enough to win football games, to get to the goals they want to get to, even if their defense only takes that half step forward? Can the offense truly carry this team? Can Ewer step up? And you know, we break it down by position, and when you do that, you put things into a silo, and you hyper-focus on the receivers, and you say, you know, I'd love a little more depth here since Nayor went down. Or, you know, you look at the quarterbacks and you're talking about high school tape, right, with Ewers. And you look at the offensive line and it's real easy to get down. But the thing that I think about, the great equalizer on all of this, is Bijan Robinson really is that dude. And he honestly makes everything on that offense better, right? Like, it's easy to look at his rushing stats and be like, yeah, that guy's good. Like, don't forget how deadly he is in the passing game. Like, I was reading a draft. They were trying to, I even remember the website, and I apologize, I'm not giving them credit, but they were breaking down the breakout player of this season, and they basically said, like, all of the advanced stats say that Bijan should be just so crazy good this year, you know, based on his yards after contact. I think he averaged like 6.1 yak as the rushing yak yards after contact last year. His yards after catch in the passing game plus depth of reception for running back are both like 88th to 95th percentile. Like, he just does everything well. He talked in the offseason about being a better pass blocker. Like, the guy is looking for ways to be better. And so when I talk about unlocking the offense, like, for me, the biggest storyline is, you know, can Bijan really rise all, can he be the tide that rises all boats, right? Like, can he really do that? Can he stay healthy enough? Can he take a bigger workload? Can he help in the pass game? Can he help block in the pass game? Can he really get those yards on third downs if we end up running it? Cause we know you want the ball in his hands. Like, can he really put in a Herculean effort that makes our offense what it is?
The crazy thing about Bijan is that he talked today in the media availability, and I say today because we're recording this on Monday to put out Tuesday morning, that, like, he's willing to do more, which it's one of those things, like, is there any more he can do? But he was like, they asked him about working with the redshirt freshman quarterback, and he said, I told the kid when all else fails, just throw the check down. And, like, that is the attitude that you want from your bell cow. It's just like, I'll never forget hearing a kid say this to me. He said, God gave me big shoulders for a reason. I could carry a lot. And that is like the mindset that Bijan has going into the season. Like, the good Lord gave me big shoulders for a reason. And, like, I just absolutely love that. Now, hopefully it doesn't get to that point where he has to rush 40 times in a game like Charlie Strong did Deontay Foreman trying to save his job. I don't think it'll get to that point, especially because there are multiple running backs that can carry the load. But if you've known me for any amount of time, you know that the storyline that I'm absolutely watching is the trenches. 100% of the time, that's going to be my answer day in, day out, and twice on Sundays. Is what does the offensive line look like, especially now that Anguilau is hurt? What does the offensive line look like where they're going to have to depend on a bunch of underclassmen? What is the defensive line going to look like? Who are going to be the guys? Are they going to be able to generate a pass rush predictably? Those are the things that I'm going to watch, because I think that those are probably the biggest linchpins to what this offense and defense can be. If the offensive line goes from a D minus, like I said before, to a C or even a B, I don't want to get greedy, this offense can be good. If the defensive line can go from not being able to set an edge to setting an edge or being able to stop run, they were terrible against the run, being able to set and maintain against the run last year. Arkansas ran all over Texas. Iowa State ran all over Texas. And so, like, again, can the defensive line meet the challenge? Because that's where it all starts for the defense. That's where it all starts for any sort of semblance of successful defense, is can you get the running back? Can you stop the run to get an offense off schedule? And can you put a quarterback out of his rhythm and out of his three steps and pop to be able to create some disruptive plays? Those are the two things that I'm really paying attention to.
Yeah, I mean, you're probably correct. You have the SEC mentality, Gerald. The trenches, like, look, I'm a fan of the Baltimore Ravens at the NFL level, and they basically do things the SEC way in pros, right? Like, every year they draft maybe some linebackers and a defensive line and an offensive line and, like, just work on the big fellas. Like, they never take, you know, running backs, receivers. They do get some defensive backs, but focus on defense, focus on the trenches. And you know, that's what we're going to see in SEC football. That's where it's heading. And that's where this coaching staff clearly is prioritizing the future. But what about the now? What about this year? What about, you know, players who are on the roster who have paycheck seasons, right? Looking at you, Tavondre Sweat, Keandre Coburn. You know, what about, you know, any of the offensive linemen who want to elevate themselves and lock a spot in for the next couple of years, like carpe that DM, who's gonna do it with no real seniors on the offensive line now that Anguilau has suffered? But, you know, nonetheless, like, you've brought in a lot of young players. If you're doing a NCAA football simulation, like, maybe just let all the young players play and deal with the warts, and they get really good by their fourth year, and you win national championship. But that's not necessarily real life. That's not how we're doing it. So it's a combination of those guys will get their chance. You'll bleed them in. But who's going to step up? Like, who out of the the offensive line who's in that room who's returning is going to step up and say, all right, with Angelou down, I'm going to be the guy. Is that Jake Majors? I mean, who's stepping up to be the leader there on the defense? Which one of those really talented players and recruits is going to step up and say, all right, we aren't getting beat for 200 yards a game in the running game, you know, giving up what felt like 9 yards a carry in some games. Like, we're not allowing that because of the name across our chest. We won't do it. So who steps up in those as you know, the older players, and which young players, you know, make themselves unbenchable? So in the trenches, that's where it all happens, right? You could throw deep passes, catch long, you know, balls, intercept some passes, whatever, but, you know, 70 times a game you have 10 large humans going up against each other, and whichever side wins that usually allows your percentage efficacy to greatly go one way or the other, right? You stop a run or you get a run. Bijan, I talked about yards after contact, but, you know, what if he didn't have to? What if, you know, he had the Emmitt Smith luxury where, you know, at 5 yards past the line of scrimmage, he gets to decide who he makes miss, right? So I agree. I think, Gerald, you're absolutely right. And that's, you can't talk about Texas football any season, but certainly this one, without looking at the big folks on both sides of the ball.
You know, I'm always looking at the big folks, Kyle. So when we look back at this season, like we asked so many of our guests, when we look back at this season in December, hopefully January, fingers crossed, how will you measure its success? Like, when we look back and say this was a successful season, what would you say?
Sark himself went out and said, you know, look at year two Saban, look at year two Pete Carroll, look at, you know, people have also thrown out, look at year two Bob Stoops. You're playing with fire if you put yourself in those types of comparisons, because those are programs that immediately left the, you know, 5-6 win first year stratosphere and went into the playing for college football, you know, playoffs or premier bowls or national championships. Like, from year two on with those guys, that was the standard. And I like that Sark isn't backing down from that. You don't say that and then be an 8-win coach. There's a guy down the road who does that, right? He and his fans talk a big game and gets plaques with years on it when they win a national championship, but they win 8 games, like 75 years without winning anything of any merit. But that's not Texas, and that's not Sark. And so I think when you judge this season, it's how clear are our steps forward, right? I was looking at the roster composition, and Sark talked about as soon as he got here that he wanted to change it up. 57 out of the 85 players on this roster are freshmen or sophomores. A lot of key guys we've talked about in our previews of each position and in this one are going to be contributing as freshmen and certainly as sophomores. 35 out of the 80 rostered guys are new, brand new, net new, walked in. Sark said it in his presser this week, like, more than half the team wasn't a 5-7 team. This is different than last year, but is it different in a significant way? And do you see a difference in mentality? Do you see a difference in attitude? Do you see a difference in hustle and effort? Do you see a difference in execution, right? Like, do you see a difference? Does that, I don't measure that with its X amount of wins. I measure it with a little bit of the eye test here to say, does it look different? I mean, I've said it on a couple podcasts that have had me on as a guest, bless their souls. Texas was not a 5-7 talent team last year, so you don't have to build from a 5-win team talent wise. It wasn't, right? They besides Arkansas, they had a chance and probably should have won every game they played. Like, they led in the fourth quarter of Oklahoma State, Baylor, OU, like the you know, the best teams of the conference last year. Like, there was no talent deficit. It wasn't that this is a 5-win team that you're now having to revolutionize, right? It was a buy-in. It was a ninth consecutive defensive coordinator, right? Like, I'm exaggerating only slightly. So when I say that, to button this answer up, that's getting a bit rambly here, I measure the success with, does this look different? Are they winning the close games this time instead of losing them? Are they stepping away from teams instead of allowing them back in if they build up first half leads? Do they have that killer's instinct? Do they do they respond when all these freshmen we're talking about inevitably have bad plays? Do they get back up and go make a good play to make up for it? Or do they get down in the woe is me's, right? So it's a lot of how does this team, you know, the underneath Texas just underneath it and over to the left is the heart, right? And how much of that are they going to have? How much of that are they going to represent through 12 games in the regular season? And that's how I'll measure it, right? Is does this team take that step forward? They don't have to win 11 this year, but do they show the things that an 11-win team ultimately has that you can build on?
I'm kind of in alignment with you there, Kyle. Like, I think my biggest want from this season is to not have so many podcast and post game reflections that were like, what just happened? Right. And I say that like anecdotally, but I think everybody knows like what that feeling is, where you're sitting at the game, like the OU game is the perfect example, right? Where Texas is cruising and then it's like, what on God's green earth just happened, right? Like less of those moments this year where it's just trying to figure out where did the game lose, or being able to pinpoint exactly where the game was lost. It was that play. It was that interception. It was that whatever, fill in the blank, that turned the tides for Texas. Again, Texas was in this position to beat and should have beat both of the teams that played for a conference championship last year. Like that is an incontrovertible fact. They both had comebacks against Texas, and we can talk about reasonings all day if we want to. But I think for me, it's being able to turn the corner that they've been standing on for 3 years. Can this team put it together? And again, there was another coach 3 years ago, but like, can they turn the corner? Can they put it all together? Can they turn the five-star talent into five-star results? And that to me, and again, I'm not expecting undefeated year this year. The breaks had to go all right for Texas this year to get to that point, and the breaks have already not gone right. Again, we talked about Mayor and Anguilao being hurt. But I think from my perspective, Texas being able to step on the field and not walk away with a what on earth happened loss, and you'll have one of those because you're playing so many young players. That'll happen occasionally, but for it to happen six freaking times in a row, like all six of those losses were what just how I say Iowa State wasn't. Iowa State just beat Texas into the ground early and often, but five of those six losses, just like, how did this happen? What happened? Like, did not see that coming type of situations. And that to me in year two is inexcusable.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. And I do like looking at this through our own lens. Because Gerald, while he is the nicest guy I know, I hate seeing my sweet podcast host just be frustrated beyond means on Saturdays. I like talking to you when we win. So give us more of those. But Gerald, we're doing a season preview this year, but let me throw just a wild hypothetical because we haven't talked about this and I'm curious. If Texas doesn't lose the most wild of those games, right? Kansas, just say, even if it's terrible and it goes to overtime, the right thing happens as the world is supposed to happen and they don't lose that game. And they also, even though OU mounts a nice comeback, they come up just short and Texas is able to hold them off. And so they're 7-5 instead of 5-7. Presumably they're some bowl game. Whatever happens in the bowl game, I'm not worried about. They could lose it for all I care. They still lose the same way to Baylor, to Oklahoma State, to Arkansas was tough. But like, that's the season. Are people looking at this team entirely differently if they're able to pull out those two games that basically came down to two plays, three plays, but you could pick any of 50 different plays that didn't go Texas's way out of those two games? Like, are we looking at the season as we project this next one completely differently if they're 7-5 instead of 5-7?
In my mind, I think so. And really, the games that jump into my projection more than that are like Arkansas and Iowa State, right? Like, those two are the more inexcusable ones in my mind. Like, you shouldn't come out and just absolutely crap the bed. But like, if Texas is 5-7 instead of 7-5, you might be right that we're predicting it. We're talking about a 9-win season, right? But there is, that's not what happened. But I do think there is, like, there's this world that we live in which all of the tails that came up tails last year come up heads. And we're talking about Sark in his first year figuring it out and getting it right. Because, again, a lot of those games felt like coin flip games. A lot of those games felt like if one break happens differently, if Casey Thompson, his thumb is okay and he can have a little more zip on some of those deep balls, right? There are a lot of opportunities where things can go right for Texas, where it Sark has an 8-win season in his first year, and people are like, oh, this thing might get figured out. And it's hard for me to live in that world, but I think there is a bit of a how do we properly modulate expectations factor that goes into this. And maybe that's a good thing for Sark and his staff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. Like, I'm not trying to let him off the hook. That is what happened, right? And you have to own that. You have to live in that, and that makes it all the sweeter if you can get it figured out. But I just curious, because I like I said, I've been on other podcasts and I've talked to fans of other teams, and we do this, right? There's so much that we consume and take in and store in our brain that we eventually like just kind of wash away any of the nuance and erode down to its like its absolute foundational. You were 5-7. You were a 5-win team last year, and I understand that. But again, like I said, this is not a 5-win talent team. There are some deficiencies in this team, and there were huge deficiencies last year. But if that's a 7-win team last year, or even 6, whatever, and we're talking about the steps up, it just feels like that's a more realistic summation. But they did lose those games, and so that is a mentality thing. And so all the stuff I said previous to this still stands. I just wonder how unlucky they were and where the, you know, exactly where the Chicken Little falls. We'll find out, right? In less than a week, we'll find out how this team plays. We'll get to start talking about 2022 and not for a nice change about 2021.
Okay, so let's close the book on the previews, Kyle. Your prediction. I hate doing predictions, but I'm going to force myself to it. What is your record prediction? Vegas, before the injuries, had Texas at 8.5 wins. What's your prediction? And if you pick a bowl eligible record, what bowl do you think Texas ends up in?
I think 8-4 feels right. I think, you know, barring something wildly crazy, like I think they're going to lose against Bama. You'll find out some things, but I don't think you have to measure your season against Bama. Again, we're not talking about an 11-win team. We're not talking about how do we get there this year. We're talking about do we show up and play. So that's a loss. You know, some combination then of three in conference. That's, you know, Baylor, OU, Oklahoma State. I'm hoping the TCU curse is over now that Patterson is gone. West Virginia, right? Like out of those five, you find three. I think they're going to handle Iowa State, who lost, you know, 99% of their production. I think they're going to get that monkey off their back a bit. I think the Oklahoma State game has been one score like the past six. Like it's even when Texas isn't good and Oklahoma State is really good, it's a close game. That's going to be a close game. And so does that go Texas's way or does it not at the end of, you know, the way the schedule lays out? They have some tough games on the road this year. And so I just think it feels to me like three conference losses. But, you know, if it comes down to that last game against Baylor and things are, you know, everyone's beating up on everyone and that still means you have a backdoor into the Big 12 championship, then maybe this team gets up for that, right? But to me, 8-4 feels right. And you get to a bowl and you're putting me on the spot that I have to pick a bowl.
Pick a bowl.
Like Texas always gets the Alamo Bowl, but, you know, it just always does. But maybe this will be the year, depending who's in, if anyone makes it up to the playoff, wherever teams fall, maybe this is the year Texas gets the Cheez-It Bowl, which always seems to be a wild and crazy bowl. Maybe I'm just projecting that one crazy, crazy one. But, like, a good ACC team in the Cheez-It Bowl feels like it would be fun. Like, that feels like... you know, whoever we get out of the ACC, there is a Mac Brown sized thing there, though I don't think they're going to be great this year. But, you know, if it's the other team, if it's NC State with their really great quarterback, if they're a little below where they want to be, does that, you know, that'd be a fun matchup in the Cheez-It Bowl, something like that. But ACC Big 12 Cheez-It Bowl to me feels like, all right, we're back in bowl contention. Win that bowl, baby. Get back. That would give you 9 wins via this projection. I'm saying 9 wins with a bowl win. I mean, that's a heck of a year.
I would count it. And I fall in the same camp. I've said it in multiple formats, and I'll keep saying it. This is going to be a crabs in a barrel year for the Big 12. And so there's a high likelihood, like, if things break in the way that I think they break, that, like, Black Friday game, both Texas and Baylor are, like, 6-2 heading into that game, and whoever wins gets into the Big 12 championship game on a tiebreaker. Like, I could see that scenario playing out perfectly because the Big 12 is just such a mess this year. We don't know what OU is going to be. Again, I'll never predict a down OU year until I see it, right? I'll give you the prediction in December when OU actually has a down year. But like Oklahoma State reloading a ton, Baylor reloading a ton at the skill position, still really solid at the core. Iowa State, don't know what they're going to be. Kansas State, people are really hot on Kansas State, but I watched Adrian Martinez play, and so I'm not really feeling it. Again, they could be really good. Deuce Vaughn is an incredible back, and they've got the new offensive coordinator. I say new, Colin Klein's not new to Kansas State, but he's new to the position, right? But like, we don't know what the Big 12 is going to be. I think people are picking the over for Kansas at 2.5, which means that they're probably going to win a couple of conference games, right? And so, like, this could be the year where things get really messy and Texas backs its way into that Big 12 championship game. And I'm sitting at 8-4 as well. I think Bama, you can chalk it up. My hope for Bama is that Texas doesn't get embarrassed in the same way they did against Arkansas. There's a high likelihood because Will Anderson is an animal, and like, the only way that I think he doesn't absolutely disrupt Texas is if he like misses the plane for some reason. But like, I'm an 8-4 guy. I put it in the BON roundtable. Alamo Bowl is always where Texas ends up when they're in that like middle of the pack. But 8-4, going to the Alamo Bowl, ending up 9-4 in year two after you go 5-7 is not bad to look at. And so there we have it. Season previews are done. We'll be back on Thursday to talk specifically about the ULM game, so we'd love to have you there as well. You've got a Westcott and Cameron Winning Is Hard podcast between then and now. We'd love to see you back on Thursday. So now's part of the show where we whip around the rest of campus and we down the 40. Kyle, all is right in the world. The volleyball team is on the court and they are dominating. They headed to Columbus in the heart of Big Ten country, in the heart of what is considered, what they consider themselves, the most elite volleyball conference. Now, granted, I think they have like 5 teams in the top 10 or 6 teams in the top 10, so they're really good. But newly minted number one, Texas, who jumped Nebraska because of this win over Ohio State, sweeps them 3-0 on Friday, 3-1 on Saturday. Friday was a little tighter than Saturday. Saturday is deceptive at 3-1 because after that one, Texas kind of cruised.
Yeah, and look, it was a good chance to see. We talked about it in our kind of little brief preview before this game, but there's a ton of depth, a ton of players. Who was going to be Coach Elliott's rotation? You knew Logan Eggleston would be fantastic, and she was, right? She really, truly was. It looked like they are going to be really, really salty at the libero. Their setting was amazing. Molly Phillips looked great in some spots. Skinner from Kentucky looked, she had points where she looked every bit the All-American. So, I mean, it's going to be names that you become really familiar with over the course of the year. But this was a really, really good test and start because though Texas was preseason number two and now number one, and though they were really good, this was a bit unusual for Texas that there was this much new blood being vetted. And again, it wasn't, other than the fact that there's just so many good players that they have to rotate in a bunch of people in this offseason. But, we'll see as they get to their exact rotation and who besides Eggleston is a for sure thing with multiple players who've been all conference and various conferences coming in. And there's probably like 10 deep of just really all conference level or higher play on this team, and really, really, really good win to start the season. I went back and looked last year was, straight set sweeps against very, smaller teams, right, that Texas should have beat. This was like, ooh, we're starting off tough here. Let's see how this goes. And I think they responded really well on the road in Big Ten country.
They got punched in the mouth on Saturday and then came back and said, no, you don't do that. And like absolutely cruised in the end, which is pretty incredible. So Logan Eggleston was just back in her like form. She's got like, it's hard to be mad at her, but like that risk reward style, like the high risk, high reward style is just how she plays. It is what makes her great. But there's always just like one that I'm like, could you just get that one in? But it's fine. It is what it is. But Texas back in action, hosting number 5 Minnesota on Wednesday, going through, knocking off 2 of the top, hopefully, Big Ten teams. And then they head out to Cali to take on Stanford this Sunday. Soccer splits the weekend series with number 1 North Carolina and Florida. North Carolina absolutely cruised in, I say cruised in this one, not quite as cruised as the other one, but 2-0. The Tar Heels were suffocating. Texas only had 8 shots in the game, so definitely suffocating. And then Florida, Texas actually had to battle in this one, but came away with a 3-2 win in that one.
Yeah, North Carolina looks every bit as good as their number 1 ranking. Coach Coach Angela Kelly did an interview before the game and talked about, you know, in my 4 years at North Carolina, we only lost one game in 4 years. So, like, kind of, you know, say it a little bit. Like, the team's good, but let's see if they're, you know, one game in 4 years good. But they're definitely great for context. They beat Baylor 6-0. So, I guess that's certainly an upgrade in that one. But, yeah, they're a really good team. Texas knows their level that they need to get to with a bunch of returning super seniors, but a lot of sophomores and some freshmen contributing. You know, they have some room to grow for sure. And, you know, they know where the standard is, where they need to try to get to. Florida, a really good SEC team, came in, and this was, I think, a really good test. This is a game that Texas would not have probably battled back for in previous years. And the goal specifically that Emma Reagan scored was a freaking, like, blast. Like, if this was a La Liga team who hit the same goal, it would be on SportsCenter's top 10. Like, just a ball came to her outside of the box, and she just absolutely crushed it in the upper 90. Beautiful, beautiful goal. Just, you know, really great fight. Trinity Byers continues to be one of the best forwards in the country, bar none. Not as a sophomore, not as a Big 12 player, like just one of the best goal scorers in the country. So really excited, you know, to see her in year two as well. And Savannah Madden, a graduated player in a super senior, super, super senior year, coming back and looking big especially the Florida game. Though, again, they got two goals in North Carolina with 23 shots, 8 of those on target. So she was big in that one too, to keep it respectable.
Yeah, for context, for the 2-0 win, the loss at North Carolina, North Carolina beat Baylor 6-0. So just adding some context, could have been way worse. At least 300% worse could have been. So Texas moves to 2-1 on the regular season. They head a little West Coast jaunt. I hear that the Pacific Northwest is really nice this time of year. They're going to head to Oregon to take on the Ducks Thursday night before staying out west for Gonzaga on Saturday. And Kyle, no results yet, but cross country, one of our low-key kind of favorite sports to talk about, they start on Thursday. So when we are doing our preview podcast for ULM, cross country will probably already be done running through the woods and doing that. The Tornado Watch Invitational on Thursday, so we'll have results for them next week.
Best name invitational in the country.
And so now's the part of the show where we honor one of the best traditions in all of college athletics, Big Bertha, and we bang the drum, brought to you by Joe Ruiz. So Kyle, what are you banging the drum on this week?
Gerald, between keeping up with, you know, 20 sports on campus and all the rosters of each and recruiting and players who commit and decommit and players going on to the next level and playing professionally in various sports, like, there's a lot of names to keep in your head. And there was one that popped up a couple days ago that it slipped my mind. I hadn't thought about in a while, admittedly, but it was a feel-good story, and so I was glad to think about it, and I was glad to see some good news, right, for former Texas defensive end Peter Mpadji, who was himself, you know, a big recruit, like a, you know, four-star recruit in a couple classes ago. But basically, he medically retired from football in 2019 with cardiomyopathy during his freshman season. He was stated earlier this year, he's not fully healed. But this week, on, I believe, Saturday, Sunday, he posted a social media post, and it was great to see almost every Longhorn player who has been in the program in that time reposting it, like just the Longhorn love and brotherhood there. But basically posted about his successful heart transplant, right? Which, I'm not a doctor. I don't know all the specifics. I can break down a defense. I can't necessarily break down a heart surgery, but it was really, really amazing in seeing that this person who was, you know, an incredible athlete at one point in his life was rendered to needing this to survive, and then getting it, and now seeing what he does with the rest of his life, how he takes this and creates a great life. Just the humbleness that he posted, you know, about it with tells me that he's on the right track and he's going to do great things. Just a reminder. I mean, we always say it every time a player chooses to go in the transfer portal, every time a player like Darian Brown or that big tackle from, I'm blanking now, from Westlake, who ended up not playing when we were in school, who had a heart issue as well. Like, when these players don't end up doing exactly what they thought we hoped they would when they were 17 and committed to UT, they're still a part of the Longhorn family, and they're still thousands and thousands of people who are rooting for them and wishing them the best. And so seeing that support of Longhorn Nation rising up and wishing him well and reposting and wishing, you know, feeling the good vibes before we start a football season, when I know it's easy to be angry and think about these guys and other sports, these gals as positions. They're human beings who go through a ton, physical, mental, emotional, whatever, in real life too, in addition to playing all these sports that we love to watch. So really good reminder, really good story. Just so happy for Peter Mpadji and his family.
These stories are so tough because, like, it's impossible to separate, like, why we know Peter Mpadji and the sports of it. But, like, these moments where a player has where a human has the opportunity to have a second leash on life is just absolutely incredible. And so we're obviously thoughts and prayers go out to him and his family. We're just so glad he was able to have that opportunity and get the transplant that he needed to improve his life and really save his life. So I'm banging the drum this week on Florida A&M University and the state of HBCUs in the United States. If you didn't know, there was some fear and trepidation toward the end of last week that Florida A&M was not going to have enough eligible players to field the team for their game against North Carolina this last weekend. And if you're unaware, you know, Florida A&M is an HBCU and they are, this is basically what they call a bye game, right? For these types of schools where they will be paid several million or plus dollars by a large school to come in and fill out a schedule to be a pretty easy win for North Carolina. And those $1 million buyouts, those $1 million trips for them generally fund the entire athletic budget for these schools for a year. And so Florida A&M's inability to make this game would have literally crippled their athletic department beyond what it already is. And so the players today released a statement Monday at the time of recording. It was Sunday, and it kind of came to light on Monday. They sent a letter to the president of the university on Sunday, and it came out to the press Monday. And it is so bad there. Like, they have, like, their financial aid is delayed. The players aren't able to buy books or to get unlocks for online courses or able to pay bills. Like, they've had to pull out classes. They've been evicted from their apartments because they weren't able to get their financial aid payouts. They had their top player, a guy who was an All-American for them, Isaiah Land. He's a guy who might end up playing in the league because he's so good. He was academically ineligible for this game, not because of his grades, but because the one person that works in the academic advising for Florida A&M University was incorrect about the number of classes he needed to take in order to be able to show good academic progress, meet his APR goals, and be eligible. They had 26 players that were in a similar situation. That's why it was iffy that they were going to be able to make the game. And so it's insane to me the state of historically black colleges and universities in this country. These were initially started because black students, black academics were not allowed to go into segregated universities, so these were created. Currently, as it stands, HBCUs account for 20% of the black college graduates in the country. They are backbones to people of color being able to have access to higher education. It is huge. Places like Prairie View in Texas, right? Like, these types of places are huge for black students who want to go and have that academic experience. And the fact that they are so poorly funded and supported in this country is ridiculous. And so I've talked about it before, but this isn't just for HBCUs. But when we talk about bye games and these bye wins for college programs, it is asinine to me that flagship universities like the University of Texas or North Carolina aren't doing those games for in-state schools. North Carolina A&T is around the corner from you, Mac. Like, inject that money into your state's schools, the schools that people that can't afford to get into, can't pay their way into North Carolina or the University of Texas. Prairie View, right there. Let's get them on the schedule, right? Plus, like, let's get the Prairie View band at DKR. Like, let's just freaking do it, right? Like, there are such cool opportunities of ways for this to work where you can, one, get that win that you so desperately need to keep your schedule moving and inject some funds into a school in your home state that desperately needs your support. That's all I'm saying. Banging the drum on schools needing support and the flagship universities of those states can and should assist with that.
That's a really great one, Gerald. And hopefully everyone hears this and you know, speaks to somebody, tweets about it, writes to somebody, lets them know. Forbes did a study and looked at just how much, you know, HBCU land grant institutions were underfunded via, you know, versus their equivalent predominantly white institution counterparts, right? And over, since that information was available, like 1987, I think was the first year they were able to acquire that. So it could be much, much worse. But in 30 some change years, right, 35 years, basically looked at if each student was funded at, and they have multiple schools, but they do have Prairie View listed here, which you referenced, right, which has 8,621 full-time enrolled students. The amount that that school has been underfunded per pupil in that point, if just each school at an HBCU got the same as a student at UT, Prairie View A&M would have $1,081,126,113 more awarded by the Texas state government, right? That's a lot. That's B with a billion. I mean, I know it's over 30 years, but it's a lot. And they have for North Carolina A&T, Florida A&M, Tennessee State, you know, the list goes on and on and on. It's billions of dollars we're talking about here, and that's a whole other conversation about fixing that funding. But I love this idea that Gerald is making here. What ways, instead of fixing everything, what ways can we fix a little? Can we help? Can we improve on a day when, you know, or a week when Duke volleyball player talks about going to BYU as the only African-American on the court and having racial slurs shouted at her while she's serving from the Provo crowd? You know, we're still in a world where everything isn't figured out, but what can we do? And I love that Gerald's out here giving us concrete solutions. You're immense, Gerald. You're always on the right side of history. So keep it up.
And that's all we've got for you this week. Kyle, where can the good folks find you on the internet? You can follow me on Twitter. I am at GH Goodridge. Follow the show on Twitter at Longhorn Pod. Facebook and Instagram, The Longhorn Republic. Or shoot us an email, longhornrepublicpod@gmail.com. Winning is Hard will be with you tomorrow. You can check out their preview episode. Then you'll have our separate preview episode on Thursday. Thank you so much for being here. We will see you back on Thursday. And until then, hook 'em.
Hook 'em. Fund your schools.